The dream, which separates things and breaks them down, creates the new. Charles Baudelaire.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with professor and chair of the Department of French and Italian and interim director of the Psychoanalytic Studies Program at Emory University, Alyssa Marder, about Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams.
This is the navel of the dream. There is often a passage in even the most thoroughly interpreted dream which has to be left obscure. This is because we become aware during the work of interpretation that at the point there is a tangle of dream thoughts which cannot be unraveled, and which moreover adds nothing to our knowledge of the content of the dream. This is the dream's navel, the spot where it reaches down into the unknown.
The Theory of the Unconscious, Dreams, and Psychoanalysis with Alyssa Marder on Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Alyssa Marder, a founding member of the Emory Psychoanalytic Studies Program, about Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams.
The wishes which are represented in dreams as fulfilled are not always present-day wishes. They may also be wishes of the past, which have been abandoned, overlaid, and repressed, and to which we have to attribute some sort of continued existence only because of their reemergence in a dream.
Alyssa Marder, professor of French and comparative literature at Emory University and distinguished international faculty fellow at the London Graduate School. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's the interest in Freud?
When I was a junior, I decided to go to France. And at that time, it was a big age of French film theory, which was largely influenced by psychoanalysis. And there was a graduate program called the Centre du Cinéma de la Critique à Paris, a center for criticism and theory that was basically theory, like literary theory, critical theory, for American graduate students who needed to learn theory to do their film PhDs. And I was an undergrad. And to make a long story short, I applied to that as an undergrad. So I was one of three undergrads who were enrolled basically in this graduate theory program in Paris at the time. And as part of this graduate program, a number of French intellectuals were hired in as contract workers to teach these film graduate students something about psychoanalysis. And there was a woman who was brought in, and her name is Marie Dubuisson, and I say that because she had a huge influence on me. She's not very well known, but she just died this past year. And she was analyzed by Jacques Lacan. Now remember that she was brought in to teach us Lacan so that people could apply Lacanian concepts to the study of film. And I was studying that too. But the concepts were so much richer than the application that they were being put to, that I became more and more interested in those Lacanian concepts. Lacan's notoriously difficult, and he's kind of annoying. But in order to understand Lacan, you had to know some Freud. So, in fact, I started reading Freud seriously just to help me read Lacan, because I had started with Lacan, and it would be like, as Freud says, and so I'd be like, what did Freud really say? And when I went back to see what Freud really said, I began to become astonished at how complicated, how interesting, and how radical his approach to basic problems in human experience was. The dream thoughts to which we are led by interpretation cannot, from the nature of things, have any definite endings. They are bound to branch out in every direction into the intricate network of our world of thought. It is at some point where this meshwork is particularly close that the dream wish grows up like a mushroom out of its mycelium.
What's a mycelium?
It's a root network. Like, oh. You know how mushrooms have rhizomatic networks under the ground? It's whatever gives it that kind of infinitely webby kind of connections. It's root work, is basically how to put it. There's another story that's sort of tangential to this, which is that this was also a time where feminist literary criticism and feminist theory was spending a lot of time arguing about whether Freud was the devil, whether Freud really was the worst thing to happen to the women's movement and to women's rights, because Freud talked about penis envy and castration and the Oedipus complex, and there was no recognition of all kinds of aspects in women's lives. So some feminists were very anti-Freudian, and there was a movement that took off in England of certain very leftist Marxist feminists who were like, no. If you're interested in feminist theory, if you're interested in this, only Freud can help you understand how women got put into this position. So Freud is useful for that. So I was getting it from both angles, kind of the Lacanian thing, and then I was interested in feminism, and then I sort of started reading more and more and more Freud. And the more I read, the more I became enchanted at how rich and difficult and interesting it was to watch him try to solve one problem after another. And what struck me more and more was how incredibly honest he was. That is to say, intellectually honest. Even though as a writer, he's a wily coyote and you have to watch him like a hawk. You always have to say, what is he really thinking about? Because his rhetorical strategy is to seduce you very often.
You were saying in the Interpretation of Dreams, he had 500 pages.
Yes, exactly. He's controlling, he's trying to persuade the reader of something. But so there's one thing, you can look at his own argument and his rhetorical strategies, but you also have to ask yourself, once you start entering into his world, what is bothering him? Sort of what problem is it that he's trying to solve? So from the beginning, when Freud started doing what we call psychoanalysis, which is roughly in the 1880s after his work with Charcot and Breuer, Freud has a set of problems that he's looking at, and he comes up with provisional solutions, puts something out, backs off from it, doubles back, claims to have solved it, knows he hasn't solved it, goes back over it, then thinks again. And so critics of Freud are very quick to say, look at that, he contradicts himself all over the place. But in fact, those contradictions are a sign of his honesty and his intellectual rigor. It's just a dream. You're not fighting for freedom. You've been fooled. They've got tools to keep you asleep. And your soul's alone. Your mind is a phone and it's ringing. But you're dreaming.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Professor Alyssa Martin about Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams. Freud has just so made his way into the pantheon of an American cliché and consciousness. Could you help us a little with the difference between the unconscious and the subconscious?
Okay. Well, in American popular culture, or in popular culture more generally, people often confuse the two. And people often speak as if they're the same thing. But the word subconscious has as its prefix sub. Sub means just under or away. So the subconscious is just something I'm not thinking about right now. And if something is in my subconscious, it means that it was once conscious, or it means that it's something that hasn't quite occurred to me, but it could occur to me. So the subconscious is merely something that isn't present to consciousness. And the subconscious is something nonetheless that is made of the same conceptual material as consciousness. So even if it never has been conscious, it always could be conscious. The unconscious is something very different altogether. The unconscious is something that could never be made conscious, is a mental act, a psychic operation, an organized set of meanings, an organization of psychic activity that is radically inaccessible to consciousness. And the unconscious, as such, is something that one can never know, one can never see, one can never describe. And so you may ask, how do you know it's there? It doesn't make sense in the normal way. You can't find any direct proof of it or access to it. And Freud deduced the presence of the unconscious when he discovered hysterical symptoms. And that was the first place where he very famously encountered women, particularly women, in the Salpêtrière with Charcot, who had physical problems for which there was no physical explanation. And he noticed, for example, that there would be a woman who was paralyzed or who couldn't walk, and they could analyze the body and realize that there was nothing wrong with the body. And actually, most interestingly, his first perception of symptoms had to do with paralysis of body parts that corresponded to the image of the body rather than to an anatomical joint. So let's say if you're paralyzed and you're paralyzed physically, you can find you'll be paralyzed at one part of your shoulder, your elbow, whereas these paralyzed women were paralyzed from the place that would appear if you looked at the image of a body rather than its anatomical joint. He realized that the paralysis was a kind of a representation. It was already an image. It corresponded to an image. And at that point, he started to say, oh my God, this body that doesn't move, if it's a representation, maybe it's trying to say something. And once he realized that the body could be enlisted into saying something that the person could not say in any other way, and that's where he started to first come up with the unconscious. And the unconscious was that thought is a way of explaining why certain kinds of expressions or certain kinds of thoughts have to use detoured or non-direct, non-verbal, non-conscious, not thinking ways of expression to make themselves known.
Dreams.
And so that's where we go from symptoms to dreams. Dreams are psychical acts of as much significance as any others. Their motive force is, in every instance, a wish seeking fulfillment. After working with his hysterical patients, he then realized that many of them were having dreams, and that each one was unlike the next, but that they had similar formal qualities, that they were disjuncted, for example. So dreams do not tell a linear story, and they use absurd images that, if you think about them, produce associations that go in many different directions. The fact of their not being recognizable as wishes and their many peculiarities and absurdities are due to the influence of the psychical censorship to which they've been subjected during the process of their formation. And that's from Freud, The Interpretation of Dreams. So once he started noticing that there seemed to be these patterns of how dreams were producing images, he then started to construct this idea that dreams were actually meaningful, that they were mental acts, and that they would be mental acts that could tell us something about unconscious operations.
Right, the place where unconscious communications are received.
The place where unconscious communications are received. What Freud most famously said about dreams is he said that they're the royal road to the unconscious. And by that he meant, in that old expression that comes from the Romans, the royal road, is the quickest, most direct route to the unconscious. Burning child dream. A man's son had died, and the corpse is laid out in one room, and there are candles. So the man had hired an old man to watch over the body so that he, the father, could sleep. And the father falls asleep.
Dreaming, I was holding.
dreams that his dead son comes to him and says, "Father, can't you see that I'm burning?" And when he hears the words of the dead son, he wakes up and he sees through the door that a candle has fallen down on the body of the dead son. The guy who was supposed to be watching him has fallen asleep, and that the body of his dead son is burning.
But I don't have you, but although it seems I still have you, if I still have dreams, and all day long I sat and dreamed of you.
And so this dream, which is a very famous dream, has brought on a lot of different interpretations, a famous interpretation by Jacques Lacan, another one by my friend and ex-colleague Kathy Carruth, because it raises a lot of questions about the difference between what's going on in the dream and what's going on in the outside world. Mm-hmm. Because in the dream, there's a tension, because does the father have the dream so that he can go on sleeping? Because if he goes on sleeping, he's actually prolonging the life of his dead son, because his dead son is still alive in his dreams. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense in which the wish that is producing the dream is to keep his son alive. And it's the very desire to keep his son alive that actually prevents him from responding more quickly to the stimulus. And so the body of his son burns so that he can have the dream.
But I don't have you, but although it seems I still have you, if I still have dreams, and all day long I'll sat and dreamed of you.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Alyssa Marder about Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams.
There won't quit raining, the sun won't shine. It's a picture perfect painting of your heart and mine. I'm wrapped up in surrender, and your voice is on my mind. Your skin, it shines like glitter beneath the candlelight.
You suggest that the realm of the night is brought into the day because we're working much later.
Freud is writing at the very end of the 19th century. So the book is published at the dawn of the 20th century in 1900. But my pitch was that interest in dreams exploded in the 19th century. So 50 years before Freud, or even 60 years before Freud, there started to be a general obsession with dreams. And that obsession with dreams shows up in the work of many artists, many painters, many poets. Writers and poets. This from Helene Csikszentmihalyi: "If I stopped dreaming, I shuddered, I would crumble to dust."
I feel like we're dreaming, let's dream all night. We'll smile as white as snow and shining like the sun. Your lips are like snowflakes melting on my tongue. Wanna scream your name from the highest mountaintop. The kiss feels like a flame and I don't want it to stop.
This from Baudelaire: "Dreams, always dreams. The more ambitious and discerning the soul, the more dreams distance it from the possible. Every man carries within him his dose of natural opium, secreted and renewed endlessly."
And I swear time you laugh and I can feel your heartbeat beating in time. Well, baby, it's still raining, let's stay inside. You don't need to take your lips off of mine. I feel like we're dreaming, let's dream all night.
At the beginning of the 19th century, 1820s and 1830s, you have industrialization and you have also the institution of artificial lighting in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And the effect of a working day now that regimented people and urban experience where people are brought together in this working day in ways that become more stressful and in which time becomes regimented and regulated in certain ways, with a day that is expanding now because with gas lighting and artificial lighting, activities that were once only part of the day now can be carried into the night. There's something about an increase in consciousness of that day that becomes more and more stressful, more and more day. And so as the day moves into night, my hypothesis, and I have to confess here that this hypothesis is helped by years of reading the work of Walter Benjamin. This from Walter Benjamin, in the world's structure, dream loosens individuality like a bad tooth. But my hypothesis is that poets and artists sort of wanted to take back the lost experience of unconsciousness of the night and bring it into the day. Mm-hmm. And this interest in dreams was to counteract the stresses and the stimulus of daytime activities and hyperconsciousness.
There's also this critique or juxtaposition between dream and science and the concept that dreams in Freudian terms is a challenge to science.
I think there's something about dreams that introduces a limit to science, mm-hmm. and that dreams are impossible objects. No one has touched a dream. No one can see a dream. No one can be present to a dream. Even the person whose dream it is, you can't own your dream. You can't possess your own dream, mm-hmm. because dreams, by definition, are not available to consciousness. So that means that if you're talking about dreams, you're always talking about dreams after the fact. So when we're talking about dreams, we're even talking about the person who's now not dreaming, telling their dream. The threat to science has to do with the relationship between brain and mind. And science can look at a brain and be interested in the way that it's put together, in how it's organized, in what parts of it do what, in what neurotransmitters, in its functions. And it's of the nature of science to have an object that can be seen, that can be measured, that can be examined, and on which experiments can be performed. The mind, and particularly the unconscious mind, and particularly the part of the unconscious mind that's producing dreams, is not necessarily easily available to the scientific gaze or to a scientific way of knowing. So I could imagine that the scientists could be super cool, and they may in fact be able to do this already. They may in fact already be able to tell you when you're dreaming by mm-hmm. brain imaging. They can show you the graphs to tell you the intensity of a dream. They might even be able to tell you whether it's a good dream or a bad dream. But they could not actually give you a scientific version either of the dream or its interpretation. Mm-hmm. And that those two things are never going to be accessible to the realm of science.
Talked about how dreams are the guardians of sleep and they're designed to keep us sleeping.
In the first six chapters, Freud tells us and announces, and it sounds like he's just making stuff up, and he says, all dreams are the fulfillment of a wish. And he says, I know you're not going to believe me. I have all different kinds of dreams. Why can't you say that some dreams are wish fulfillment dreams, some dreams are fear dreams, some dreams have other affects? And he's going to say, you're going to object to my idea that I'm going to claim all dreams are a distorted fulfillment of an unconscious infantile wish. So that's the first 500 pages. And really, it's not until you get the idea of what dreams are for that you understand why he argued this. He argued this because the body needs to sleep. And there are all kinds of claims that get put upon the body and on the mind for attention. And consciousness can be awakened by stimulus that comes from the outside world all the time. So there's certain stimuluses that are coming from the outside, but also stimulus coming from the inside. One can be hungry, one can be thirsty. And Freud is saying, how is it that the mind came up with a way of just shutting down the system? And what he said was that these unconscious wishes that are given expression, basically they're there to satisfy a wish, to keep us distracted and to make sure that all of the sensory apparatus gets quieted down so that sleep can take place. So he tells the story of a young medical intern who liked to sleep late. And so when the alarm would go off, the intern was supposed to get up and get ready to go to the hospital to go to his job. So the alarm is ringing, and instead of getting up and waking up and going to the hospital to his job, the intern just dreamt that he was already at his job, and therefore he could go on sleep. So that the dream would actually participate, it can incorporate stimulus coming from the outside and make it not something that the mind has to pay attention to. So it's a way of taking attention away from consciousness, being more like a magnet so that consciousness is not woken up.
I like the idea that the doctor imagines that he's already there, so he doesn't have to get up. Yeah.
And that explains why something actually happens in your dream that didn't happen. So you take a wish, like, and then, oh my God, it's granted in my dreams, so I'm there, and therefore that keeps me asleep.
What do you say we can take from Freud pragmatically into our lives as we dream, imagine our dreams, imagine our wishes, think about our futures?
We need to learn to cultivate the patience and the respect for forms of writing and expression that take work, that take time, that are opaque, that don't make sense, and that don't have an immediate application. So we have a moment where facts now are subject to interpretation, which they shouldn't be, and other modes of expression that ought to be subject to interpretation, like poems or works of difficult art or things that take time to understand or things that seem like they don't make sense, that those parts of culture have receded and haven't been given as much respect or interest or care by general people. So I'm saying we have to remember how to dream in our waking life.
The moon, it shines across the face. She lives in outer space, but she don't know why.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to composers, singers, and songwriters Whitman Bransford, Scott Wosliger, and Kevin Semps, Folk Family Revival, Mike Montgomery, Chris Long, Hosty, and the Ted Ludwig Trio.
Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. A special thanks to Alyssa Martyr for helping us to understand and negotiate the sometimes difficult realms of theory, and for suggesting we slow down and take time to interpret the often surreal world that we're a part of. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Sigmund Freud. Everywhere I go, I find a poet has been there before me.